This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, this is Raise Your Game, and I'm Tasha Fusil. Now, we all have problems, be it professional or personal. When we're faced with these problems, most of us tend to fixate on it, focusing on every aspect of the issue until it's resolved. But how effective is this approach? David Niven, author of It's Not About the Shark, shows us that this is precisely what we shouldn't be doing to get to the solution. Dwelling on these problems comes with its own set of consequences. David joins us to share some simple but solid principles that will transform how we tackle these problems in our daily life. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much for having me.
So what's the title of your book, It's Not About the Shark, all about?
The title, It's Not About the Shark, is about the making of the film Jaws. And it works out that when Steven Spielberg was making Jaws, his first big motion picture opportunity, he invested almost his entire budget on a giant mechanical shark that was really going to be the center of the film. It was just going to give audiences nightmares about this sea monster, if you will. And they built the shark in California. They sent it to the east coast of the United States for filming. And among other things, they forgot to factor in salt water. And they put their mechanical shark in the ocean, and it immediately started shorting out and failing. And it failed in an array of ways. It couldn't swim. It couldn't, the jaws wouldn't work, literally. The skin of the mechanical shark puffed up like a giant sea marshmallow. And so he faced this problem in which if he tried to fix the shark, because the filming had already started, the money had already been spent, if he tried to fix the shark, he would have run out of money and time. If he tried to replace the shark, he would have run out of money and time. If he jury-rigged the shark with a little rope and some tape, he probably would have made one of the worst movies of all time. And if he'd stared straight at the problem, he would have been stuck with the notion that there is no solution. And instead what he did was he thought about a solution, because really what he wanted wasn't a working shark, it was a great movie. And he thought, what would Alfred Hitchcock do if he were making this movie? He thought, what other ways could I do this? And he came up with the idea of not showing the shark, of implying it. And so you don't actually see the shark in the movie Jaws for 81 minutes of the film. He got around the shark not working by making a shark movie without a shark. And the irony of this, of course, is that's what makes the movie memorable. It's us thinking of the shark, our image of the shark. You know, he puts the camera half above and half below the waterline and implies the shark, and he invites the audience's imagination into the story and winds up making a classic movie instead of a B-horror movie. And that's really the essence of the argument. If you're willing to look beyond the limits of the problem, you can actually come up with a solution. And in the end, Spielberg is happy that the shark didn't work because it made him create a better movie.
So what he did, you know, it's kind of counterintuitive to how we approach problems. But what is the science or psychology behind how we think about problems?
Well, the core science of this is that if we have a problem, we tend to fixate on the details of it. And that tends to block out everything else. And one of the great examples of this was a study done with engineers and two groups of engineers. One was sat down and told, draw up a bike rack so that people could put, you know, bike rack, put their bicycle on a car and transport it. Second group was told, draw up a bike rack. And in the process, they were told, here's where the difficulties are. Here's the hard part in drawing a good bike rack. So the two groups go to work drawing up their plans to create this bike rack. And it works out that the second group fixates on the details of what they were told was the hard part and completely failed, while the first group, who was just told, come up with the best solution you can, was 17 times more likely to draw up a plan that worked. And the essence of it is, if we look to the problem is just a series of things that we can't do. The problem is a series of things that are going to go wrong, and it limits us. If we look past it, then we have the capacity to be creative, to actually achieve solutions.
But does this go against the, you know, the articles out there that suggest that the first step to having good problem-solving skills is to be able to identify that problem?
Well, to look straight at the problem, it's like looking straight at the sun. It will block out everything else.
Right.
And I think the difference between the conventional wisdom and what I'm arguing is that you need to focus on the desired outcome. You need to focus on what you're trying to achieve rather than the details of the problem. What made Spielberg's movie great is he stepped back from the problem and realized his goal wasn't the ideal mechanical shark. His actual goal was the ideal movie. And so I would argue that to define the problem in business or in your personal life or in any circumstance is to limit you, is to put you in the details and the confines of the problem. It's going to tell you what you can't do. To really achieve something, you have to think about what is it, what is the outcome that you're seeking, not what is the problem that you're attacking.
And, you know, a lot of businesses, they're built on the back of identifying problems or pains. So how does this work?
Sure. Well, what I write about, I use several examples in business of companies that look at a circumstance, put the word problem in it, and then go about attacking the problem instead of achieving the ultimate result. One of the examples I use here in the United States, one of our major companies is Procter & Gamble. And they had two lines of coffee in the 1990s. One was a consumer-driven line of coffee that was not terribly popular. It was not a great subject of consumer support, but sold a lot of units. And they also had a specialty coffee line that sold coffee to cafes and coffee shops in Europe. And it was enormously popular, but at a much smaller scale. And they looked at these two and said, which of these is Procter & Gamble? Which of these is real coffee? And they came to the conclusion, let's stick with our consumer brand and let's dismiss. And they literally sold off their European coffee line because they thought, well, who really wants to go to coffee shops and spend all their time on coffee? That's not realistic. And so they took these two assets and defined one as a problem and threw it away. And then, you know, in the coming years, come to learn that people love coffee shops and that the market was moving toward coffee that people enjoyed, not coffee that people tolerated. And in the end, they wound up transforming themselves from a international leader in coffee sales into a company that's entirely out of the coffee business today. And, you know, I think that in any circumstance, if you are simply driven by looking at problems, you're going to deny yourself opportunity.
David Niven talking to us about how to solve unsolvable problems. More in just a moment. This is Raise Your Game on BFM 89.9. Good morning. You're still tuned into Raise Your Game with me, Tasha Fusil. I'm speaking to David Niven about his book, It's Not About the Shark, which is all about how to solve unsolvable problems. Earlier on, we spoke about what inspired the title of the book and also about how the brain usually deals with a problem. David also talked about how focusing on a problem is only going to make matters worse. So how can we find a solution without examining the problem?
Well, there's a couple of ways that you can make yourself better and more open-minded when you're encountering any kind of a challenge. And some of them are ridiculously easy to put into play. We are, for example, more likely to be creative in our thinking, to come up with new kinds of solutions if we are fluid and active in our movements. So an experiment was done in which half the participants sort of stood rigidly straight with their arms straight out, and half the participants were allowed to move around and asked to flap their arms around as if they were a bird. They were then given a creativity test, and the arm flappers by far scored better because a fluid body helped them be fluid in their thinking. And one of the ways you're going to get around staring straight at a problem is not doing exactly the same things that you always do and not looking at things exactly the same way you always do. So flap your arms around like a bird. Another great and easy practical effect was shown to be breaking your routine. If you always get up at exactly the same time and you always take the same path to work and you always assemble your sandwich in the same order, break those routines and you'll be able to look at the challenges around you in a different light. And the third way that's kind of fun, an experiment was done and half the folks were asked to try and come up with a solution just straight off. The other half were asked to first think about yourself when you were 7 and then try to come up with a solution. And the folks who spent a moment thinking about themselves as 7-year-olds did better. Why? Because they weren't looking at things the exact same way they always do. Mm. And really, you know, to get better at coming up with solutions, you do have to be willing to just nudge yourself a little bit out of the confines of the way you always look at things and the way you always approach things.
So these are some of the things that we can do to sidestep that instinct we have then to fixate on our problems.
Well, that's right. You know, that if you just repeat the same behavior, you know, that you've traditionally had, we all respond to problems. Problems gain our attention. Problems, you know, are enormously inviting to us. And if we simply do what we always do, then we're going to repeat those behaviors. Now, you know, I write about, you know, several examples. You know, one that seems a little bit silly, but it gets at this idea that you can think past your first ideas. There was a writer in America who, when he was writing a new story, would, you know, instead of just looking at the draft and making notes and so forth and sort of being locked into his first version, he would print out his drafts in different sizes so that he would have one where he, you know, expanded the size of the print and one where he shrank the size of the print, to just give himself a different context for when he reread this. Mm-hmm. So that it would invite him to look at this in a different way. And that's really the key to coming up with solutions today that you couldn't come up with yesterday.
So with that story, I mean, with that example, you're saying that the first draft is not necessarily going to be the best.
Well, that's right. And you know, we have this tendency to want an answer, and we want it now. And the more we fall victim to that, the more we're going to trap ourselves in. Spielberg's first answer to the shark not working in Jaws wasn't going to be to creatively solve the problem by not showing the shark at all. His first answer, you know, would have been really pedestrian. You know, we have to be willing to step past that. And I write about one study that I really love that asked folks to imagine an alien on a distant planet and to draw that alien. And we think of creativity and imagination is boundless, you know, that we're all capable of, you know, these wonderful thoughts. But when the researcher did that, almost everybody drew a space creature that had elements of an Earth creature. You know, it came up with, you know, two eyes and they were symmetrical, and this is a creature that generally that walked on legs and all these properties that we would see on Earth. And gradually, as the experiment continued, the researcher gave folks the prompt that imagine a creature on a distant planet who has to be able to fly to survive, to get food, but also is covered in fur. So the prompt then put people in the mind of two things, something that's a bird and something that's not a bird. And all of a sudden, their creativity exploded, and they were coming up with all kinds of imaginative creatures, and they were one-third as likely to sort of confine themselves to creatures that had Earth-like properties. And what was the difference between the two groups? The first one just went with the first draft. All right, what's a space creature? It's something like E.T. or some image that combined elements of what's available here on Earth. That second group took off those shackles, took off those limitations, and really came up with something creative. And you can apply that logic to whatever you're facing. You know, whether it's a work situation or home situation, your very first answer isn't going to be this creative blast of originality. It's going to be something familiar. And you have to be willing to shake that up to come at this and, you know, reach a point where you're actually offering a unique solution.
And you also talk about how working harder at something, you know, can exacerbate a problem. How so?
Well, you know, we like to think that the solution to anything is a little hard work. And it doesn't matter what it is, work a little harder, try a little harder. You know, there's no downside to working a little harder. Well, it turns out there's actually a great deal of downside to working harder, you know, if you're stuck within the confines of a problem in the first place. You know, if you are stuck with a problem and you work harder, what you're actually going to get is more stuck in that problem. And, you know, as a default, we glorify effort. And it turns out there's a huge, huge difference between effort and results. And, you know, one of the studies I write about really kind of, you know, gets at the heart of this question. They took a group of newspaper editors, and they basically tried an experiment in which one group was paid essentially by the headline, and the other group was not rewarded by the effort whatsoever. And we would think, well, clearly, if I'm going to pay you more to do something, you're going to be more likely to do it, and, you know, the results are going to flow from that. And in fact, what the researchers found was, once you started associating the reward with the process, they did less work. They achieved less, and they didn't have the level of sort of creative commitment to the task. And, you know, sort of the irony of this is, you know, you are better off if you are intrigued. You are better off if you are engaged than you are if you are just throwing yourself with every bit of ability, with every ounce of energy at a task.
Yeah, I read somewhere that giving the, you know, you should only give the incentive after the result or the outcome has been achieved, without offering that incentive in the first place.
Right. You know, what we want, you know, most, you know, what really gets us to do something is some kind of sense of connection to it. And, you know, the reward itself is relatively isolated from that. One study looked at, literally, they gave folks this task, put this puzzle together, and they looked at whether people kept trying to figure out the puzzle after they were told they could leave, basically. And the less that was online, the less that was at stake, the more likely they were to keep fiddling with the puzzle. And it was simply because, you know, they felt free to be interested in it in and of its own self. And so where's your best answer going to come from? Where's your creativity going to come from? It's going to come from being genuinely intrigued. It's going to come from caring about this. It's not going to come just because there's a lot at stake. That by itself is not going to make you better at doing what you're doing.
As we talked about before, a lot of these tips, these suggestions for overcoming problems are quite counterintuitive. Are there habits or things that we do that are good that we just need to develop more of?
Well, you're right. A lot of this is counterintuitive, and, you know, a lot of this comes from instincts that don't necessarily serve us well. I would say one of the things that we do that we can cultivate is a willingness to listen to our own voice in a circumstance. And one of the things that I think stymies folks is that your first step toward creativity, or your first step toward a great answer, is likely to be met with skepticism from somebody else. You know, if you are thinking creatively about a situation, if you are seeing past the problem, it's likely that the person in the next office or the next person that you talk to isn't seeing that. And so one of the healthier habits is, you know, is a willingness to really be true, you know, to your own voice, to be true to your own perspective. You know, if you're going to see something more clearly than anybody else, you have to be willing to stick with that and not let, you know, not let other folks, you know, who are still focused on the problem, you know, talk you out of that. You know, another thing that I think is a positive habit that we can, you know, that we can utilize if we do it well is a core sort of willingness to see things and see their opposites. And this is one of the great pieces of research on where great ideas come from. You know, really focuses on the idea that if you can, for a moment, look at a problem as an opportunity, as the old saying goes, if you can, for a moment, see the potential good in something that others might be seeing as bad, you really do have an opportunity to reshape things in a fundamental way. And, you know, certainly whether it's reshaping a movie or reshaping a company, if you can see the good in what others are automatically seeing as bad, you know, you have a tremendous opportunity to make an effect that nobody else can make.
Thank you so much for your time, David.
It's been my pleasure.
David Niven, author of It's Not About the Shark. This is Raise Your Game with me, Tasha Fusil, on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.